Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, October 6th. The government shutdown moves into a second week, and pressure is growing as the president withholds even more federal money from states and cities. Senators are preparing to take another vote on possibly ending the shutdown today. We will hear from Senator Mazie Hirono this morning. What the push for seabed mining could mean for marine life, like sharks and rays in the Pacific. And young playwrights from across the country tackle gun violence. We hear about a local production that hits the stage tonight, The Power of a Short Play. And we celebrate a music score for a short film born out of a difficult time, a Pacific Island community story set to music. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. In news from our nation's capital, senators are expected to take another vote to try and end the government shutdown. We are moving into the second week of a stalemate that is affecting federal services because workers have been furloughed. This morning, we talked to Senator Mazie Hirono as the lawmakers were expected to take its fifth vote.
This is a series of votes that we've been taking for the last 3 days to put forth our proposal, the Democratic proposal that will end the shutdown, and that is by restoring health care to the millions of Americans who are relying on it. And so that is one of the major reasons that we are going to be taking several votes today. But the Republicans insist on their CR, which does not restore health care to Americans, and they're sticking with that. These are the same people who tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act dozens of times at one point in their whole iteration of how much they care about health care. Another big, fat lie.
Well, going into the vote today, I don't know, are you hopeful?
The Republicans have not sat down with us yet. So until they do, they apparently are going to stay in hiding, especially in the House. They're not even in session because the Speaker doesn't want his House members to have to be confronted by their own constituents, who I'm sure by now are contacting their members, their Republican members, to say what's going on, because they are getting their notices of increases in their premiums. And these notices are going to indicate healthcare, Affordable Care Act premiums going up from, say, $500 for a family of four to $1,000 a month. That's a huge increase. But they're getting those kinds of premium notices pretty much all across the country, places like Georgia, I'm sure Louisiana, which is Speaker Johnson's own constituency. So notices are going out regarding these kinds of massive increases on their Affordable Care Act premiums. Families can't afford these kinds of increases, which is why millions of them are going to lose their health insurance. And the ripple effect of all of that is going to be massive on our healthcare system.
And so to be clear, this is something worth fighting for, and this is why the delegation is towing the line.
You know, the Republicans can end this shutdown right now if they restored healthcare to the American public. What is so hard about that? Really. But they love to blame the Democrats. I mean, they're blaming the people who do not have control over the House, the Senate, or the White House. People who blame people who do not have the so-called power to do anything about it, that's pretty rich. But that's what they're doing. Yeah, rather than facing up to the responsibilities and the fact that, you know, there are millions of people in the red states, so, you know, to politicize everything based on whether you're in a red state or a blue state is totally irresponsible and harmful. And my hope is that the people who are being impacted in states like Georgia, Louisiana, and all these so-called red states, they will be contacting their members of the House and Senate and saying, what is going on? My premiums are going up by 100%. We can't afford it. What are you going to do about it? So I would think that the Republicans are getting those kinds of calls, which is why, again, they are in hiding in the House.
Well, you know, I just happened to be at the VA offices on the first day of the shutdown, and it was changing minute by minute about whether they were going to remain open for the rest of the week or just for the day. And when I checked the website today, it looks like they're not even taking appointments virtually, which is what they initially, you know, were discussing.
Well, even before the shutdown, agencies like the VA have been cut substantially so that the people who call the VA would get a recording or they wouldn't get information they needed. That was already happening before the shutdown because we have a regime that is very busy dismantling government agencies except for the Department of Defense. I refuse to call it Department of War because only the Congress can make that kind of change. And Homeland Security. They have so much money that they could afford to give people $50,000 in bonuses to sign up to become an ICE agent. So aside from the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security, pretty much all other departments prior to the shutdown were massively cut of workers. Hundreds of thousands of workers were either fired or they were given early retirement for getting paid to do nothing. Our taxpayer monies went for that. But that was already going on. So departments were getting dismantled before the shutdown. And now Russell Voigt is saying he wants to eliminate even more federal employees because that is his goal.
We'll talk about that.
To dismantle government services.
Talk about that because, you know, there is a concern about the government services that people are getting from the VA or the Social Security office, key agencies that are lifelines for so many voters.
So there was a time when there was some thought about closing some Social Security offices, regional offices, et cetera, and there was a huge hue and cry. So that was paused. But it's just a pause because this is a regime that wants to cut government services. They are dismantling government. Even the Department of Education, for example, prior to the shutdown, they eliminated half of the Department of Education, Federal Department of Education. They would like to eliminate the whole department, but only Congress can do that. So they're doing all kinds of things to make things a lot harder for educational services to be provided, including the student loan program and you name it. So that is already going on. And I think one of the things that I hope the American people are beginning to figure out, this is not a regime that is there to help us. They are there to help themselves. The only people who are making out on this whole situation is Trump and his family, and his billionaire buddies who are getting their massive tax breaks. Well, everybody else is getting harmed by all the things that this administration, this regime, is not doing, not supporting. I mean, the billions of dollars in research funds that are being cut from universities, including hundreds of millions of dollars from the University of Hawaii, all climate change kind of research being cut. So the research that will enable us to make decisions based on facts, science, and information, if the administration doesn't feel like supporting these already funded programs, he just cuts it.
Well, I think the concern is that the stalemate will only accelerate those cuts. You know, it's very chaotic, and Democrats are trying to push back. But, you know, this is not a drill, right? This is happening, and the harm is just growing.
Yes. The thing is that if we just lie flat, they're going to roll over us and keep on rolling over us. They're already doing it. There are already 300 lawsuits that are, and more are filed every day, including the Portland and Chicago. They're filing a lawsuit because they don't want the National Guard troops coming into their cities, creating a situation which could lead to violence, which is what Trump wants, by the way. He wants an excuse. He calls these deployments, this is a practice. Sending our troops to these cities as a practice for the Department of Defense. See, that sounds ominous, doesn't
it? Yeah, the training, yes.
There are hundreds of lawsuits to stop Trump from his lawlessness. And we're counting on the courts. The federal judge in Portland just stayed troops being sent to Portland, but this is not going to stop the regime from continuing to have ICE agents bust into people's homes, arresting people, including children and U.S. citizens who are being detained, some of them for days and hours. So this is what is going on in our country. And if we Democrats lie flat and let them roll over us, this kind of lawlessness will continue. Now, you know what? There are things worth fighting for. I'd say health care of millions of Americans. That's worth fighting for.
Well, you know, we know you have had your health challenges, and, you know, this is something that, you know personally. And when folks are out there dealing with these abrupt cuts or hikes in their budgets, I mean, it's really very alarming.
Well, Catherine, I know what it's like not to have health care because I grew up as an immigrant not having health care. My mom worked really low-paying jobs when we first got to this country, and she had no health care. And as a child, my greatest fear was that she would get sick, and if she got sick, she couldn't go to work. And if she didn't go to work, there's no pay. I mean, we would already run out of money by the end of the month, even when she was working full-time. And so I know what it's like for families to face these kinds of concerns. And really, before the Affordable Care was passed, there were a lot of individual bankruptcies filed because massive, unpredictable health costs really it harmed a lot of families to the point where so many of them would have to file for bankruptcy. And I think we're going to see an increase in personal bankruptcy due to unexpected massive health care costs.
That was Senator Mazie Hirono, who we spoke with this morning about efforts to end the stalemate with Senate Republicans and reopen the federal government.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
In India, herds of elephants are on the move. They're being pushed from their native habitats into places where they're newly encountering humans. This man says he saw a huge elephant running and stepping over everything. Elephants and humans learning to live together. Next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Distance Learning Executive MBA and Master of HR Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
A team of Hawaii researchers are raising the alarm over the impacts of deep sea mining to aquatic life. Their new scientific study points to a concerning overlap between the habitats of sharks and rays and proposed commercial mining activities. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with two of the researchers. Aaron Judah is a graduate student at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and Jeff Drazen is a professor in the Oceanography Department. Judah starts with how deep sea mining would affect sea creatures like sharks and rays.
Deep sea mining is said to take place and have impacts both on the seabed, on the bottom of the ocean, but also in the water column, in the pelagic zone, where all these wider open ocean sharks are living. There will be a collector vehicle on the seabed that will be picking up something like polymetallic nodules, which are the deposit for which these minerals that people are interested in for mining are located. It's like a potato-sized rock, almost. And we have collector vehicles going in and grabbing those. As you are driving these collector vehicles over the sand, you're kicking up the sediment, you're disturbing it. A lot of sharks, specifically the skates and some of the ghost sharks, a unique cousin of the sharks and rays, lay eggs that sit on the seafloor or on deep sea corals. So if you have a vehicle running over the seafloor, this poses an issue for nurseries. This is affecting the prey sources for many of these animals, and it's going to change their behavior and where they're trying to feed. In the water column, you're going to have a discharge plume, because when you're grabbing all these nodules and these deep sea deposits from the seafloor, it's going to go up and you have to deposit the waste somewhere, all that sediment that's going to be kicked back down. So the thought is you'll have a midwater plume. And of course, you have these sharks and rays and other species that will cross this plume. This plume has sediment, it has toxic metals in it. So it's going to be a problem for filter feeding animals like manta rays and whale sharks. It will reduce visibility. It may affect prey, you know, little tiny fish eating the sediment and then bigger fish trying to eat that and sharks trying to eat that. So it has widespread potential issues for the food web itself in the deep ocean.
And what did you set out to do with this paper?
So what we found with the current conversation on deep sea mining was sharks, rays, and chimeras, this group of super unique, amazing, and iconic species. They're the second most threatened vertebrate group on the planet. So there's already overfishing and climate change and a number of other things affecting them. One thing that really hasn't been discussed is the potential of deep sea mining to pose additional risk on top of this. One third of sharks and rays are already threatened with extinction, and yet more issues are coming to light that could potentially elevate this risk. So I feel that this paper was born from a need to let the international community know that we need to start considering these species because they're already imperiled. We need to understand how this may affect them too, so we can better make conservation measures into the future.
Maybe, Jeff, share a little bit about what we know, like a little bit more broadly than just sharks and rays, about these biodiversity impacts and the kinds of monitoring that seabed mining companies already have to do or are going to have to do if they want to mine the seabed.
Yeah, so I can speak to the rules and regulations on the high seas. And in federal waters, that's still being negotiated, I think. We have some old rules, but they're likely to change. So I won't comment there. On the high seas, the International Seabed Authority requires any country or contractor sponsored by a country that wants to mine, they have to have a license area on the seafloor, and they have to conduct what's called an environmental baseline study. So they have to study the organisms that are living there, their diversity, their abundance, their biomass, the food webs. There's a variety of components that need to be understood. And that baseline data has to be submitted to the International Seabed Authority and becomes an open, publicly available resource. And so this is a really good thing. This provides knowledge of this system before potential impacts begin. Once mining occurs, then there needs to be a monitoring plan so that that company is gathering data and evaluating what their mining activity is doing to that ecosystem. There are some concerns because they're in the laws and regulations. There's very little on what happens should they find that they are having really adverse impacts. And of course, it's probably the mining company that's going to be monitoring their own activity. And so some argue that this is a big conflict of interest. But there are rules and regulations to conduct environmental research, both baseline studies and monitoring. It's a really good set of regulations. We just think it has a bit of a hole and more attention needs to be paid to these very large top predatory animals that are already threatened in many cases by other human activities.
And Aaron, so when you were trying to look at where there might be potential overlap between the ranges of some of these animals and deep sea mining efforts, how did you answer that question?
Yeah, so we are so data poor in our knowledge of the distributions of many of these animals. The IUCN Shark Specialist Group, so a group part of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, their job is to do the widespread assessments of, is this shark endangered? Is it not endangered? Is it threatened? And from this work, they have assembled the experts across the world and created maps, these distribution maps, that we know, okay, this animal is known to occur here. So what I did was, quite simply, was took those maps of where these animals live, and I put them over, the International Seabed Authority has open access maps of where all the current contract areas are. And once I overlapped them, some very simple analysis show that there are about 30 species or so that overlap with these areas, many of which are already threatened by other factors, and many also have important roles in the ecosystem that, you know, it is difficult to say what their loss in these areas could potentially mean or if there'll be any risks, any impacts fully at all. We just do not fully understand what impacts deep sea mining could have on them.
Yeah, you found 30 species that potentially overlapped.
Yep.
And a majority of them are threatened?
Yeah, over 60%.
Wow.
So over 60% already have quite strong concerns over their conservation. Whale sharks, white sharks, manta rays, a number of deep sea skates, chimeras, these ghost sharks. So it's not just the deep sea stuff, it's the stuff that travels down to the deep sea. So many of these animals engage in super deep diving behavior. So they're connecting the shallow ecosystems to the deep ecosystems. And this poses a concern because on their movements down, they may cross over this discharge plume, which will have to things like toxic metals and sediment and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's not just who you'd expect in the deep sea. It's other shallow water species that may not come to mind automatically when you think of deep sea sharks and rays.
I think one aspect of deep sea mining and its environmental impacts that people don't intuitively think about at first is that this really occurs not just at the seafloor. It's not just a geographic effect. The miners will lift ore and unwanted mud and seawater from the seafloor up a pipe to a surface ship in most of the technological scenarios for mining that we know about today. Once they separate the ore out, they have a waste stream. It's hard to put it all the way back down to the seafloor. So most of those companies are going to discharge that somewhere in the water column. And there right now is no regulation as to what depth that has to be at. They probably won't discharge it at the surface because we know from accidental spills and mining tests that those plumes are visible from space. So it's going to go in these deep midwaters. That dramatically increases the number of species that come in contact with deep sea mining's potentially negative consequences, the sediment clouds, the toxic metals, etc. And that includes a number of these sharks and rays, things that we don't normally think of as being deep sea species.
A question I have for each of you is whether you feel like being at UH, being in Hawaii, has impacted the kind of research you do into deep sea mining, or whether you think that listeners here in Hawaii should be better informed or know something more about deep sea mining because it's happening in their kind of metaphorical and physical backyard.
Yeah, I think being here has definitely put forth just how expansive deep sea mining is. So the Clare and Clipperton Zone, which is the area where these nodules, many of the nodules are located, is, 800 to 1,000 miles away. That is not as far as you would think it is. It's pretty close to us. So close, so that I think, and it's possible that animals could move between these two areas too, migratory species, but we're not sure. I think having it so close to us means that we have to be highly invested and aware of the potential impacts and how they could express themselves back here in Hawaii. From the shark and ray perspective, we have large migrating species. Does this mean that impacts in the Clare and Clipperton Zone will mean impacts on the populations here in Hawaii? Sharks have so many important cultural value to Hawaiians and people here as guardians, as protectors, as, also for tourism. And Hawaii has been a leader in shark conservation globally. So I'm wondering, from this standpoint, we really do need to be careful about how we proceed with these, especially these highly vulnerable species. But it is just so close to us here in Hawaii. So it's part of it for sure.
Jeff, anything to add?
We really are sort of in a position of having deep sea mining potentially occurring in our backyard. As Aaron mentioned, the Clare and Clipperton Zone is not that far away to the south of us. To the west of us is what's called the Prime Crust Zone. This is the area of seafloor that has the oldest seamounts in the world, and they've built up the thickest cobalt crust that miners are interested in extracting. And so we are really in the center of most of the mining interest. And it's Hawaii, but it's also other small Pacific Island states. They also have nodule resources and seamounts with crusts on them in their exclusive economic zones, as we do here in Hawaii. Some believe that there are nodule resources in the southern extent of our exclusive economic zone, just south of the Big Island. We know, for instance, that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has already requested information on selling off leases of the abyssal seafloor in American Samoa for nodule mining. And we don't know what they're going to do there. They've requested public feedback and received tens of thousands of comments on this. But I suspect that in the near future, the southern extent of the Hawaiian EEZ could be another place where the federal government could potentially lease lands for mining should it be found that there is adequate mineral resource there. So we need to really be paying attention to this. It could have a much more direct effect on folks in Hawaii than any other part of the nation, frankly.
Those were scientists Aaron Judah and Jeff Drazen talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Judah and Drazen's research was published last week in the journal Current Biology. We'll have links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
This month, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Literary Events for the Keiki. Your children will join local authors Pua Aquino and Keolani Nitani in fun, interactive activities. From helping to write a story on the fly, to exercising their green thumbs, and moving to get those wiggles out. RSVP for free at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is already a part of your weekend. Join Peter Sagal, the panelists, and HPR to see the show live on October 9th and 10th at the Blaisdell Concert Hall. Take advantage of the double date discount. Buy three tickets and get the fourth for free to share the laughs with friends. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait. Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners and Hawaii Pacific University.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Daniel Kahikina Akaka VA Clinic, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
This evening, the University of Hawaii will present a series of short plays as part of a nationwide initiative called Enough. It's to give teens an opportunity to write plays that confront gun violence. Six short plays were selected from 700 scripts submitted from across the country. The Conversation's E.W. Gibson talked with Professor Mark Branner, who works in theater for young audiences, and two graduate theater students, Cameron Richardson and Jack Romans. Richardson helped get the plays produced. She and Romans each direct one of the plays. Richardson starts us off.
So we have six really bold, really impactful plays that will be put on. They're about 10 minutes each, and they are written by teens aged 13 to 19, which is just incredible. It's such an opportunity to uplift the voices of people who can't vote yet, and the voices of people who are having to deal with this in their daily lives but don't have the control over their circumstances. So folks will get to see these six plays. We are actually really excited that we are partnering with Moms Demand Action and Students Demand Action Hawaii chapters to have a talk back after the event. So we really aren't just expecting folks to come and listen. We want them to engage. We want them to understand what is being done and where this conversation is in Hawaii.
Yeah, that second part seems to be pretty vital. What strikes me about this exercise is, in fact, that it is teen writers, and they're, I would have to imagine, be something cathartic about this. Not just, obviously, catharticism for people who experience firsthand, secondhand even, these heinous events, but students in general across the country who go to school every day carrying this as sort of the larger reality that they live in.
I remember seeing an ad for bulletproof backpacks a few years ago, and it has never left me. And I can't imagine what it's like for students that are going into schools every day right now.
I once observed at my daughter's school all of the students doing an active shooter drill, and I just happened to be going by the back fence as this was happening, and I saw 200 elementary school students with their hands in the air, and you could hear a pin drop. I've never forgotten that. It was a haunting moment. that silence. And something I never experienced as a student, and a new challenge that students face in the 21st century. Jack, you're directing one of the plays. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the play you're directing.
Yeah, so I'm directing a piece called Oh Look, Another School Shooting by Matthias Finley. And the piece starts with this chorus of phone calls between parents and children talking about the concerns happening when there is a mass shooting, before looking at all of the different online discourses, all of the ways the news sort of sensationalizes these conversations, all while there's a student from the school who's being ignored by these conversations the entire time. This writer's from Wisconsin. We're doing this piece here in Hawaii, and it can be easy for us to be looking at these conversations as something to just lead to galvanizing other types of discourse, like making it bigger than the actual events, when part of what makes this whole series really significant to me is that these are six teen writers saying their stories and their responses to the gun violence that is existing and in their circles and their worlds. And rather than just using the statistics of what happens with gun violence with kids, this effort is taking the voices of those kids and making that the center of the series.
Yeah, something that really struck me as I was looking at the descriptions of the plays, student writers from all across the country, Georgia, Wisconsin, as you mentioned, Florida, mm-hmm. California, Mississippi, Texas. I'm sure there's some great texture there in terms of the mix of, I don't know, tones and atmospherics and voices.
I very much would agree. I think, too, something that's really lovely about the set of plays that they've curated is how each writer leans into putting things in front of audiences. One of the plays has a movement piece functionally. It talks about, you know, making a gun into something that is ephemeral so that people can engage with it more so like philosophically, this element of violence, versus other pieces are very blunt about what they bring forward. So the ways that each playwright engages is very different, as well as, you know, the cultural responsivity of like, what does a school look like for you? What does home look like for you? And also the prevalence. The play that I'm directing is Holding Space, and it is written by someone who is from the state that I moved here from, so from Georgia. And in the time right before I left, there were a series of three shootings in 1 week. And I can't imagine